Candy is over, but we're just getting started. I'm magnificent 70s perm Sarah Carradine, and I'm here with someone who always goes into the target, even if his watch has stopped, Josh Wiggler. Hello, Josh.
Hi. Hi, Sarah. Sarah, can I ask you a question? I'm sorry. That's just so uncouth. A tough way to start this one.
Could you dial it back? Could you dial it back?
I will. I'm so sorry. Trying to have some murder fun right now, Sarah, as we are launching into talking about Hulu's Candy.
What an amazing thing to do. I think it's interesting to note that we both come to this completely fresh and unspoiled.
Yes. Innocent
eyes wide open. I knew nothing about the case and I knew nothing about the show. How about you, Josh?
No, I've known very little about the show. So Candy, it's I feel like we're like cheating on Ariel and Marissa because this seems to typically be their post-show recaps beat. I know it's a true crime show. I know it's on Hulu. It had an interesting release model, not dissimilar to the interesting release model that we shall be having here with the Candy podcast, in that it aired every weekday from May 9th to May 13th, 2022, five episodes and out. That is it. Something very similar happening here on the post-show recaps coverage of Candy coming your way a little while later, a couple of weeks after the show originally aired. We're going to drop a podcast one day a week in the binge show recaps feed. Sarah, you're going to be hosting with a new podcast co-host trying to solve the mystery with you each and every episode of the podcast. So that's what I know about the structure of the show and the structure of the podcast. But all that I knew beyond that was Jessica Biel is in a true crime show and it seems like murdering is about to be occurring.
Allegedly murdering is about to be happening.
Murder.
We don't know. We have both just seen episode one. There appears to be some blood.
Just a little, a touch.
To be some concern.
Out and foul spot.
Yes. I think you'd need quite a lot of spray and wipe to get rid of what we saw in the final moments. Look, well, first, I just want to get into the Candy DNA, if I may. So it's created by two writer-producers, Nick and Tosca. Now, he's worked in horror a lot, which I find really interesting. He's done horror series for Sci-Fi, and he did the supernatural revenge tale Brand New Cherry Flavor, which came to Netflix last year, I believe, if anyone knows that. His partner in this venture is Robin Veith. And she started on Mad Men,
yes,
as an assistant writer. Then she wrote for The Expanse, which is a series set in the 24th century, up to its fifth season, if anyone knows that.
Oh, it just ended, and I'm furious that it's over.
Oh, okay, we'll take it up with Robin. Yes. And she's also produced on Law & Order SVU. Dung, dung.
Yes.
So this is really intriguing creative DNA coming from these two show creators. So they're the writer-producers of the whole series. They started working on it without any network backing, which I think is an incredible freedom to have for creators. And then Hulu came on board, I believe, last year. And now we have the result here today. We're talking about it. Last week you could have seen it. And interestingly enough, HBO Max are doing a series called Love and Death, starring Elizabeth Olsen and Jesse Plemons, about the same case.
Oh, man. And that sucks because I love both of them. I think Elizabeth Olsen and Jesse Plemons are both terrific. I don't know if you've seen the Elizabeth Olsen lie detector interview that's been going around recently. One of my absolute favorite pieces of internet content of this or any other year. So if you haven't checked it out, you definitely should. But I feel like, and so you and I have not watched beyond episode one. I'm going to keep watching. I won't be podcasting about it any further. If I had time, I would love to make it because I was really gripped. I was immediately gripped by the show. They do give you the opening credits to start things off. But as soon as we're in the action and we have this opening monologue from Jessica Biel as Candy, this like really chilling tale of it's a blessing when you get chopped down as a tree and turned into a house. God has other plans for you. I don't know if that feels
turned
so
into
good.
Turned into a crucifix,
right, yeah,
for Jesus to be nailed to. So if you don't get what you want, children, just think God has another plan for you.
Yeah. So Sarah, as a Jew, my skin is crawling right now. I don't feel good about any of that.
As an atheist, I was like, fucking Christians.
Yes. I was so immediately immersed. You know, I was just instantly drawn in. And I don't know. I mean, there's four more episodes beyond this one for the show to, I guess, potentially drop the ball or the axe, as it were. But this is just a very confident first hour of TV. That I don't know how far along the Elizabeth Olsen and Jesse Plemons version is, but do we need a second one of these?
Look, the actual crime that this is based on, and they do very much emphasize based on true events. I think
there's the big title card at the end of the episode that like really underscores that, where they're like, yes, it's based on true events, but we're taking the liberties, folks.
Yes, so it'll be very interesting. I don't know the case, and I'll read about the case once I've watched all five. But this is an event that happened on Friday, the 13th of June, 1980. So literally, still the 70s, as far as sort of culture and design and all of that goes. I had just turned 20.
Yeah,
I had nothing to do with the crime, but I'm just kind of positioning myself in time.
I love that you have to give that prerequisites. Like, don't accuse me of anything involved in the Candy murders. I had nothing to do with it.
Unless I've had an out of body experience,
yeah,
a fugue state. But the close-up, I mean, I was very tempted to say we open on some eyes because of course we must, because we open on this intense close-up of Jessica Biel, magnificent in this role. Like, this is something extraordinary, the inhabitation of Candy that she does. She's got the fantastic 70s perm. She has the big glasses. She has as plain a face as Jessica Biel can possibly give to the camera. And it must be said, it is quite plain.
Yep.
So the makeup and costume design is just brilliant here. This intense close-up on her face, her big eyes filling with emotion as she tells the story of the little tree that wanted to be good and wanted to grow, but the woodsman came along and cut it down and it was made into planks and then it was the cross. And you think, who are you talking to? Who are you? I mean, it was this incredible smash into this person that we're going to follow for the next five episodes. I mean, the thing's called Candy. It's named after her.
Yeah.
And then we pull back and we see sitting on the floor her husband, Pat, played by the wonderful Timothy Simons, who is and always will be Jonah Ryan from Veep.
Are you going to defriend me if I tell you that I've only seen two seasons of Veep?
No, not at all. Okay. There's a lot of television to watch, Josh, and we can't all watch it all.
But I do like him. And when I watched a Veep, I really enjoyed him. And he had a surprising role in Station 11 last year. He kind of like showed up in like sort of like this bit role and was like, you know, not like overly serious, but was an emotionally driven character. I was very impressed.
He's very impressive.
Shows up and immediately I'm like, ah, Veep. Sitting across from Jessica Biel.
It's a wonderful, you know, as a director, my eye immediately sees that she is sitting up on a small stool and he, all 6 foot 25 of him, is sitting on the floor cross-legged looking up at her.
Like a child.
Like a child, which makes sense because we realize that this is a story that she's rehearsing, she's going to tell at the holiday Bible camp. Three words that I'm not interested in. Holiday, maybe. Camp's good. No, it's actually, you're right. So holiday and camp are fine.
I love a show that has a series Bible. So in certain contexts, all of them could work for me.
I'll give you that.
Yeah,
but we also see, like, is this going to be the marriage relationship between them? Is it going to be like, what is this? We're so intrigued immediately. And those are two of our main characters, and the other two are Melanie Lynskey, who just cannot do any wrong as far as I'm concerned. She's playing Betty Gore. Her name is Betty Gore.
I don't want, George. I mean, it's based on a true story, so you can't say that it's so on the nose that it can't be real, but...
This is nominative determinism.
Yes, I don't know. Does your last name, like, speak to your destiny? If so, am I destined to wiggle my way out of a dangerous situation someday?
Yes, I suppose
uh-huh.
so.
Uh-huh. And Sarah, are you destined to someday carry someone named Dean?
Yes, uh-huh. I think I already do.
No, she's great. She's Betty. She's unfortunately, I don't know how much of Betty we're going to end up seeing on the show, but her husband is played by Pablo Schreiber. And this show is doing this very strange, it's like, it's meeting me in this like strange podcasting nexus, Sarah, because Melanie Lynskey is one of the leads on Yellow Jackets, which has been a yes. big podcast that we were doing on Post Show at the start of the year, and certainly will do when season two comes. Pablo Schreiber is Master Chief on Halo, which as this podcast is arriving, the finale has already occurred, and Corey B and I have talked about that. And then Jessica Biel was the star of The Sinner, that Antonio Mazzaro and I podcasted about once upon a time, but we didn't podcast about the season she was on. All of which is to say, though, all of, like a bunch of podcast shows that I've been on are colliding on Candy, and they're like it feels like I don't know about they're pandering to me. Like,
yes,
Wiggler, watch this. Here's some of your favorite people. Check this out.
It's Wiggler Nip. It's yeah. Wiggler Nip. I mean, I can't imagine that you get Melanie Lynskey and give her one episode. I can't imagine it. So if we were to think about what we're going to see in the next few episodes, I'm sure we're going to go backwards.
Flashback. Yeah, well, we need some context for the relationship for sure.
They have to go back.
We have to go back.
Yeah.
We do. Down the hatchet.
Uh-oh. Ah!
We have to make light because otherwise we're just going to be like feeling very icky the entire time. So that is the obligatory explanation of mm-hmm. the gallows humor, because this is it's very, very grim very quickly here.
Even before the event at the end of the episode, the feeling of dread, and I mean, this is why I think it's really interesting that one of the creators comes from horror. And one comes from sci-fi, or both of them come from sci-fi to some extent or another. The world creation is so incredible. And yes, I'll just echo what Josh said. Obviously, the actual killing of poor Betty Gore is not a matter for laughing. We are talking about the show Candy, which are fictional people cavorting on the screen for our entertainment.
Yeah.
I mean, were you entertained? I was gripped.
I really was. I they did some really great and very smart structural stuff within the episode that I thought really, really roped me in. You know, it begins with this story that Candy tells Pat that we were just talking about that she's going to tell the next day at the holiday Bible camp. And it says the night before, like that pops up on screen. And at first I'm like, oh, is this how we're naming the episodes? Like we'll do like some sort of strange little stylistic title card or something like that. And then I like with my mouse, I just like moused up and saw, no, it's called Friday the 13th. I was like, okay, so what are we doing? And then in the next scene, it's broad daylight and it's Betty and it's Alan and he's going off on a work trip that she's not psyched about. And she's staying at home with their baby, and she seems, you know, really sad in her life, and it seems like a very, you know, like kind of a depressing situation. And then after he leaves, and she says, "All right, bye, I'll see you in a couple days," the title card comes up right next to her that says, "The Day She Died." And this is all within what, the first 8 minutes of the show, and I'm like, oh yeah. No.
The economy of the storytelling,
yes.
In the way that they situate us in time, in the interactions between people, in these little markers, there's no exposition dumps of any kind, but we get these people. The bright sunlight with the baby just wailing. Not a scream, not very loud. Just whoever did the sound design on this baby crying is fantastic. It's a wailing of a creature that never expects to be comforted.
Yeah.
And we see Betty in bed hearing it and then heavily getting out of bed and going to get the baby. And then her husband is revealed and he heavily gets out of bed and goes and makes breakfast. Nobody's said a word. She picks up the child with the baby without speaking. He eats without speaking. It's such a brilliant snapshot of this marriage. Yes, I know people with new babies are very tired. I don't expect them to have witty repartee, but there's right. no touch or look or kiss or anything like that.
The way it's conveyed really speaks to like something has, if there was something that was there before, it feels like it's been removed from the relationship, right? From like this situation that the three of them are in, that something isn't there. Probably multiple somethings aren't there. And I do think that the way that it's framed, you're right. I mean, like there's fatigue there, certainly, but it's framed in a way to highlight some, not just, you know, imminent sense of dread, but maybe an imminent sense of dread because there is this like very pointed emptiness in this scene.
Yes. And it's not the angry arguing couple. It's the, his almost pity for her is worse. You know, you'll be fine. I have to go away. You know, I have to go away. And she's worried about being pregnant and he's just very practically telling her to take a pill. It's like, that's not what she's talking about. Yeah. Like, she might be pregnant. She's not asking you for a practical solution. And then this kind of heavy, tired woman turns, says, I don't like it when you go away. And it's like such a shock.
Yeah.
You're, oh, okay, another side to Betty. And again, this economy. And now we go to the bright, hilarious breakfast kitchen of the Montgomerys. The children are chattering and laughing. The father's being funny. They're talking about Star Wars. They're very excited. They're going to go and see The Empire Strikes Back.
Can I confess that I, so I, again, didn't know much about the show going into it. I had seen the poster of, you know, and the image of Jessica Biel with the perm and the glasses. But then I think I needed to see a bunch of other sets of glasses and then hear about The Empire Strikes Back to realize, oh, this show takes place in 1980. Okay. I was like, I just didn't, it didn't clock for me until there was a bunch of people with the huge thick rimmed glasses and it's 1980 because they're talking about Star Wars. I'm like, all right, Star Wars. Okay. I've got the context cues now.
For me, it's this incredible saturation of the yellow brown colors. Very, very 70s to me. Yes, again, I know it's 1980, but I will be yep. referring to it as 70s.
Fair enough.
Because the thing designers, just a little PSA for designers, just because something's set in 1980, it doesn't mean that the characters bought their clothes in 1980. They're going to have things from 5 years ago, you know, and particularly these suburban, these suburban lives. I mean, if you ever thought that you liked suburbia, watch Candy. It will cure you, because there's an idea as we go through certainly this first episode of the oppression of the suburbs, the oppression of the mom competition. I am not a mother. I can't imagine the hell of other mothers competing with you. Are you the best dressed? Do you do the most? When you bring the food to the holiday Bible camp, is it the most delicious? Are you the most efficient? We see people treating Candy like she's some kind of super mother. She seems to relish it. And yet we imagine the cost that keeping up in that fashion is for people.
Yeah. Yeah, no, in a very serious way, but in a way that, I don't know, for me, because of the way that the show has been set up at this point, I am finding myself in these scenes. You know, can Betty's daughter stay over for Star Wars? You know, so on and so forth. That for me, what I am focusing on in all of these moments is, what is about to happen that is going to cause lives to end? That is going to cause this person who is, by all accounts, just like, you know, doing the things that she loves and is, you know, just like being a normal civilian in their normal civilian life. what's going to happen where clearly Jessica Biel is going to kill this person. And I'm really glad, Sarah, that this is going to sound bad. I'm really glad that it happens so quickly, in a manner of speaking, because that's when I'm able to start focusing on some of these details that you're bringing up. I think for me, it's like the juxtaposition of Candy after whatever has happened. And, you know, it certainly seems like she killed Betty, that whatever has happened at 10 a.m. and between 10 a.m. and I think it's noon that we don't have fully accounted for. That's like the rest of the day that we are spending with Candy. And now the fact that we are spending none of this day with Betty, that it's becoming really pointed, like the types of duress this character might be under. Not that it's like justifying by any stretch, we don't know anything about her, but maybe it's like explaining some of the tensions that have mounted to get us to this place. And that's when I was able to like focus a little bit on like what everyone is going through, was after the murder has been committed.
Yes, or the whatever it is.
Right.
Like, we must say that in this show, it is strongly suggested that Candy kills Betty. We don't see it. We see Candy arrive at 10 a.m. She'd asked Betty what time was good for her. Betty had said noon. But 10 a.m. suits Candy better to pick up her daughter's, it doesn't really matter, her daughter's swimming suit. They go into the house. The door closes and we just watch the outside of the house. It must be said that this show, you know, strongly indicates that Candy kills Betty. We don't see it. We are left after Candy kind of pushes her way into Betty's house and the door closes. We're left with the outside of the house and the sprinklers. And this is an image we're going to return to again and again during the episode. Sometimes we hear the dogs barking. And sometimes we hear the baby wailing. And, oh, I mean, the hair on my arm is standing up just describing it. This, to me, is much more effective than if I'd seen the build-up or the murder itself. I just see this house just sitting.
Yes. And the fact that, you know, the baby is so alive in the first portion of this episode. And so that's a very important thing to point out, that it's not just the sudden absence of, you know, like for me at least, and for you as well, Sarah, like very prominent actor in Melanie Lynskey is no longer on the show at this moment. And you can imagine what has happened. But the baby is now gone from the narrative. And Candy has left the house. And there keep being these things that pop up where... is anyone going to figure this out? Is you know, because her husband, because Alan is supposedly gone for days in St. Paul. So I kept thinking, is anyone going to find Betty anytime soon? And therefore, will they find the baby? And if so, what's going to happen to the baby? And beyond that, you know, is the baby okay? Like, but did something happen to the baby as well? And so there is this moment where he calls the house. And I do think this is a kindness from the creators of the show, that the phone is ringing. The phone is ringing. It's an empty house. It's silent. And then eventually you do hear the baby crying. It's like, oh, God.
Yes. Thank God. But also now we have another concern, which is when we know that Alan Gore is away for 2 days. Uh-huh. Candy did not know that.
Yeah.
And it's something that we start to see play on her. She rings her husband to say, okay, you know, before we go to the cinema to see The Empire Strikes Back, you know, can you pick up cash? Because I've done, and she lists all the things that she has had to do in this sort of incredible recitation. And we've seen her tell a story at the very beginning about the tree, and now we're seeing this recitation of all the many things that she has done. And even she laughs and she says, oh, you know, the suburban car shuffle, it's like these arrangements that have to be made. So she rings him to ask him to get cash, and you think, does she want to tell him what happened? She talks about going to Target, but she realized her watch has stopped, so she didn't go in. She's also told that story to the women back at the holiday Bible camp. But at the end, like a patient leaving a doctor's office and turning at the door, or like Columbo turning at the door, oh, one more thing.
Yeah.
At the end she says, oh, do you know where Alan Gore is today? and her husband does not know. So the freight of what we understand to have happened and what we now are putting onto Candy, that she, a mother, is carrying with her the knowledge that that baby is by itself in the house, is really, really effective. I mean, we haven't been told yet that Candy killed her, but she did drive home with blood on her. She did take off all her clothes and carry them to the washing machine and then presumably wait for them to dry, because she then appears at the Bible camp in the same clothes. So we know something has happened. We know that the baby is alone in the house, and we know that Candy knows.
Yes, yeah. And she that scene where Jessica Biel comes home cleans herself, cleanses her soul as best as she can. You know, it's very evocative. Was really deeply unsettling. And I did mention that Antonio and I once podcast about The Sinner, but not the season that she was on. And then I watched the season that she was on after I saw the second season. And I think that I had sort of just earmarked it as it's just going to be a total cheese show. She's so good on that show too, that I don't know why when I entered Candy, I wasn't expecting that she would just be immediately chameleon style, just blend into this character. But very quickly in this episode, I think it might be this scene where she's going home and she's got the cut on her forehead and she has to clean everything up. And she's clearly, I don't know if she's processing what's happened. There's parts of me that think, was she the one in the fugue state? And is she the one who doesn't know what's just happened? And is she kind of waking up and seeing herself? There's so many questions that emerge in this moment that for me, Jessica Biel completely disappeared. And it was really impressive, very harrowing, but really, really, really well done.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that the nudity here, she has the clothes and she's clutching them to herself, not to cover herself up. You do see her whole nude body, but it's a pitiable, I mean, it's gorgeous, but it's a pitiable sight, right? not anything else. And I loved that. And yes, I did feel like they were showing us, is it a fugue state? Because she drives up, she stops and she feels her forehead, it's got a cut on it. And it's almost like she doesn't know, her hair is wet. It's like she doesn't know. And then she's moving through actions in an almost automatic way, including the repetition of going to Target and the stopped watch. Let's take a quick break before we get into the second half, the story of Alan. And we're back. We've had a shower. We've washed off the psychic blood.
Psychic blood. Oh, no. Now I need a psychic shower.
And now we're going to follow the wonderful Pablo Shriver. Again, a very good job at looking not unattractive. I mean, that's rude. Looking ordinary.
Well, yeah. Were you an Orange is the New Black person by any chance?
Yes.
You know, the famous porn stash, right? Isn't that what they call him?
That's right.
And, you know, I do think that once that's sort of that becomes your kind of signature iconic character and role, that it takes a certain amount of bravery to play a heavily mustachioed character again. And I do think that he, his whole storyline in this episode of being on the other side of this death, that he left that day and he's going on his trip and he knows, you know, obviously more than you and I do. And the rest of the audience, even at this point in time in episode one, know about the state of their marriage and the state of their family and the state of Betty specifically and the state of himself and the state of his job. But he knows that even if he is frustrated that she's calling and calling her employer and everything, that he now can't
his employer,
her, you know, he can't get in touch. And I felt that mounting dread from him so powerfully, of the increasing amount of intensity and anxiety surrounding the I can't get in touch with this person. I can't get in touch with this person. I really felt that bone deep. And I don't know if it's better or worse in the era of cell phones and smartphones and internet technology where people are so immediately reachable that now you can't reach that person. And it's like, okay, God, where are they? Like that, you know, there's just so much that's roped in and associated with that. But to some degree, the way in which their lives are being lived, it seems like she may as well be attached to her cell phone, because he says like she's always home and she's not picking up.
She always answers. And the interesting thing is she does ring his employer. His employer comes to him and says, oh, your wife called. Oh, I'm sorry. I asked her not to do that. So we get this freight of history in this very economical way where the boss is also sympathetic. So there's obviously an understanding between men about maybe Betty's going through a little bit of a tough time. The boss even says, oh, you know, when you're away, bring her back something sweet. So there's this, again, this pity for this woman. And Al Gore is not unkind. I mean, he buys traveler's checks. Kids ask your parents or your grandparents. We used to buy traveler's checks. He buys traveler's checks. She'll be excited. This is for the trip that we're going to have. And so his first
going back
call
to where? To Sweden, did he say?
Switzerland. Yeah. Where they first had a very happy holiday. So
do you think the spoon is still under the rock, Sarah?
Yeah, I do. I do think the spoon is still under the rock. Yeah. Betty certainly does.
Yeah.
And so he rings her to give her the numbers of the traveler's checks, because traveler's checks were like cash. If you lost them, you lost them. And this is the first time she doesn't answer, but we actually see her in the house not answering, which is a fantastic weapon. So the weapon of the oppressed is silence, right? They can't make you speak. I mean, maybe they can, yeah. But this is her weapon. She doesn't necessarily know it's her husband, but she just rang her husband's boss. I think she knows it's her husband calling her. And she turns the ringer on the phone down and she sits and sews as the phone rings. So we do see this first instance where she actively doesn't answer the phone. So even before he's left, he hasn't been able to get in touch with her. He goes on his trip. He's obviously called her several times, hasn't been able to get in touch with her. And his mounting dread and our mounting dread, because don't forget, all we saw was the outside of the house. All we heard were the dogs barking. And then we heard the child crying. I mean, it didn't mean that Betty was dead, except the sign that said the day she died.
Yeah, that kind of gives it up. It does kind of tell you what happened. Yeah, or at least something very bad happened.
Bad's happened. Yeah. So he calls directory assistance to try and get through. He eventually goes down to dinner with his colleague. He asks for calls to come to him. We can see that tense. This is a brilliant performance. The tension between, I'm sure everything's all right and I'm just being silly, and my wife's delicate, or my wife is nervous, or something has happened. I don't think it's a psychic instinct. I think he knows her, and as will be revealed when he finds out that she's been shot, he says, first thing he says is, we don't own a gun, which means he was thinking about her committing dying by suicide.
Yes. And I think that I think you're seizing on something that I really felt acutely and feel acutely often as like a person who suffers from anxiety is I often find myself in this place of, when am I catastrophizing about something? Like, when am I inventing something that this is not as calamitous as it seems to be? And that's it's in your head and it's going to be okay, versus no, realistically, like, something is off and I am right to be anxious about this thing. And certainly we live in catastrophic times, so the tension between these things is more acute than ever, you know, globally and personally. And I think that in this character, who knows that Betty is home, you know, that's not a value judgment, that's not anything other than that's like the nuts and bolts reality of what our life is like right now. She should be picking up. It would be one thing if she was in the bathroom and she didn't pick up the first time. Multiple calls are being placed and she's not picking up. So I agree with you. I don't think that that's like a psychic instinct. I think that that is like a very legitimately earned bit of terror based on what he does know about her and what he knows about the situation right now.
Yeah, and what we see with the other couple, Betty and Pat, is now it's part of the story because of her setting up what she's up. But she does ring him and run through everything that she's doing, and they have to coordinate cars and they have to coordinate children. So while it is while those scenes are particular to Betty and Pat, we can also extrapolate that that is this world where husbands and wives are phoning each other to sort out who's picking up the money, are we meeting at the cinema, whose child is staying over, who has to do what. And so we understand that not answering the phone for an extended period of time is highly unusual, leaving aside his knowledge of his wife's kind of state of emotions, as they would say, and mental health, as we would say now. So he calls his neighbor, Richard, yeah. Mm-hmm. And very apologetically.
Richard is, I'm Richard. Sorry. But big mood from Richard, right? Of like, oh, well, the kids are here and I can't really do. He's just like eating ice cream and watching the game though, right? Like he's lying, right? Like,
his wife's at bridge. No, his wife's at bridge.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to do it. Yeah. He doesn't want to put his shoes on.
Honestly, for my sins, big same. I don't want to put my shoes on and go outside and check on the thing across the street. Don't call me. I'm deep in my Hershey syrup woes right now. Okay, the game is on. And so it felt very human. And so this thing of like, you know, time is a factor. We don't know what's happening with the
child. There's a baby.
She might be alive but maimed. We don't know. And the fact that this is what's preventing him from going across the street when seconds matter, just nothing more than what, like human laziness is standing in the way. It's just extraordinarily real.
It's so well done from both these actors. Yeah. Oh, it's beautifully written. It's again, it's economical. And because of Richard's reluctance to go, when he finally does go, it's a very cursory look. Yeah. And he says her car's gone. So he calls Alan back at the hotel and he says, oh, I've had a look. It all looks fine. And the small car's gone, he says. So, where is she? But at least we know she's out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until 11:30 at night.
Yeah.
Richard's dinner of a slice of cheesecake, still beautifully positioned. I mean, the art direction is, I could eat it up, including this cheesecake, this perfect triangle of yellow cheesecake on the brown side table is incredible. And he is sitting in almost a fugue state himself, and he finally rings Richard again at 11:30 and says, I'm so sorry to bother you with life and death. Like, I'm so sorry. She might have fallen, he says. Richard, like all of us, could not be less interested in going. He has to bend down to put his shoes on, and I think that's the main thing for him. Yeah. He is a larger man.
That's a far distance, though, the shoes. You know, I don't want to put the shoes on.
Didn't want to put the shoes on.
And also a certain time of day occurs and the shoes are off and they don't belong back on my body.
Shoes off, bras off. Don't ask me to do anything. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing suburban-wise, certainly in the 70s, was you never called anyone after 9:30. You just didn't do it. The phone did not ring after 9:30, and if it did, it was an emergency. Yeah. Because, of course, we weren't muting and doing all the marvelous things. So Richard does go over. He sees the small car. Is in fact in the garage. He hadn't seen it before. He comes back. Now he's a little bit apologetic. And Alan has to beg him to go to the house. And now this magnificent horror set piece. Tell us all about it.
It is extraordinary because so many things could go wrong in this moment. And that was horrible. So Richard has gone across the street. He's back now that he has found that the car is in the garage. And now he's invested because he knows that something feels wrong. And I didn't get the names of the neighbors. So if you have them.
Jerry and Lester.
Okay, so Jerry is the one who shows up with the gun, right?
Yes, he is.
And so Jerry shows up with a revolver. and is standing outside, and Richard is surprised to see him. And Jerry has been sent over because who called him to go over?
Was Alan called Jerry, and Jerry's wife Ruth called Lester.
Got it.
So there's been a little bit of a phone tree.
And so they show up, then Lester shows up, and I absolutely thought that Jerry is going to spin around and shoot this man by accident, because they're so cavalierly walking into this home with a firearm because they don't know what they're about to encounter in there. So throughout this entire scene, Sarah, I'm thinking that an additional death is to occur. And mercifully, that did not happen. But one of the really compelling moments is this part where Jerry gets to the actor doesn't not only gets to play Jerry, but gets to play the audience when Richard's is looking at Jerry about what's going on, and Jerry's like, yeah, I feel it too, like something has happened, and it is this moment where like, yeah, me too, can we look and see and find out the thing that's happening, maybe can you put that gun away. But they go in, and there is, they find like spots of blood. They find,
I'm just going like, turn the light on, turn the light on, turn the light on. Oh, they're creeping around in the dark, obviously scared. Obviously they can't show it to each other because they're men. I mean, that was a beautiful little just side thing where they were but all trying to be brave. They see
there is like, there's this like, not even false bravado, but like this incredible effort towards like being solemn in this moment, you know, like the, like this intense effort towards the gravity of it.
A feeling of, you know, what are they going to do if Betty pops up in her nightgown and says, what are you doing in my house? I mean, there's that weird sort of feeling of like, it can't be what we think. Betty's just going to pop out in her nightdress. Then they find the baby.
Yes.
The baby is well, the baby is fine. But the baby's little onesie has blood on it, and now they know. So Richard runs the baby across the road, throws the baby at his wife, and goes back. And now they know, these three men know. And again, we're not shown anything, but we are shown Lester opening a door, looking back. Oh, am I all right, boys? And them kind of nonverbal. And he opens the door, he looks, and he closes the door and reels back.
Yeah.
It's horrible. So good.
Because now you know for sure what's behind the door, but they don't yet. And the phone is ringing now. And it was one of those things where I have no idea how I would act in this situation, right? But I just kept thinking, I can't believe Lester just saw what he saw and is now going to answer the phone. To have the fortitude to do that after seeing what you've just seen. Was striking to me. But Jerry, you know, registers that Lester's not good to have this conversation right now. And like, you know, Jerry like shoulders that on himself of, I'm the man with the gun. I'm the man who can deliver the news.
Probably potentially ex-military. I mean, there's something about him. He's older. He's sort of got the buzz cut.
Yeah.
And so he tells Alan, it's not good. The words Alan has been dreading hearing.
That's one way of framing it, you know? So what did you guys find? Well, Alan, it's not great.
It's not good.
Alan, it could be better over here. I got to tell you.
It could be Betty over here.
It could be Betty. Not. Yeah. Did you say Betty? Well.
Now, yes. He does say the baby's okay.
Yeah.
And you know, if somebody starts with the baby's okay, starts with it's not good, then says the baby's okay, I think you know what the next words are.
Yeah.
So it must be said, Lester and Jerry have only had a pretty quick look through the door and closed the door again. So Jerry just assumes, and he says, it looks like she's been shot. And Alan says, we don't even own a gun, which is just such a beautiful line.
Yeah,
such a beautiful line.
There's a lot of subtext there, obviously, and I think his concern over her mental health and what has been going on with her, which I imagine future episodes are going to expound upon greatly, but there's just a lot, to your point, baked into that line. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then, interestingly, we might draw some inference from it. But interestingly, Alan then calls Betty. Now, it must be said he's called her a couple of times already, sort of in normal suburban daytime, to say, have you seen Betty? She's offered each time to go and check, and he's said each time, oh, no, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Now he calls her and tells her that Betty has been shot.
Yes. And Candy has a very strange, has a very notable reaction to this. She says, wait, she's been shot? And then she puts the phone down and looks at her husband and says, it's going to be okay. And is it going to be okay because Candy axe murdered Betty? And so the news that she got shot means that, what, did somebody else come and do the job with Candy?
Or was it all a dream?
Yeah,
I didn't
right.
actually do it.
Right, right. So, and I think that the, again, you and I don't know much about the case at all other than what we're seeing in this first episode. But what the first episode seems to be trying to do is they're not showing us the killing. And what they are showing is what seems to be certainly like some measure of shell shock for Candy, and the way that Jessica Biel performs the role in this scene where she is on the, where she's on the phone and she's getting this news, and how she reacts with like genuine surprise about that she's been shot, and the way that she looks at her husband afterwards certainly indicates to us that she might be in a place where she is not fully in control of herself and her role in whatever happened. That possibility at least is being floated our way. And then I think my assumption about where the show would go from here, and I get to find out and just binge the show next, Sarah, you're going to have to be meeting this out. You chose this life.
I did.
Sarah, I told you, do you want to do this as a done in one podcast? And you're like, no, I want to do one on every episode. I'm like, all right.
I was very tempted, and having seen the first episode, I'm so glad, because there's so much to talk about it.
Yeah,
and relish. Yeah.
This definitely it, because I think that the thing that I walk away from this episode, because that's effectively the end, right? Like, she gets the call, and but then we do go and we go into the garage, and there is the axe on the ground, and it's like, okay, so some things are not adding up. That as compelled as I am by the emotionality and the mystery of it, and just like sort of the grimness of it, and as compelled as I am by the fact that I only have four other episodes to watch, mercifully, right? We stan a 5-episode TV series. That's a beautiful thing. The U.S. doesn't do this very often, so it's happening a little bit more, and it's great. The thing that I'm so drawn by on this show is the craft. I think that this is like a brilliantly crafted show. It is excellently filmed. The tension that is mounted by certain shot choices and certain omissions of things, and then inclusions of things like the baby finally crying after the phone has been ringing, like just some immaculate filmmaking on this show. And I think that you'll have a lot to appreciate in the episodes ahead, for sure.
Yes. And it does that thing. It walks that incredible line where it doesn't say, look how clever we are.
Yeah.
Look how great our design is. Look how self-conscious we are about these shots. It just gives it to you kind of purely, and it's crafted it at its absolute best. I'm loving it. I'm very excited. Like when I asked to do Our Flag Means Death, I didn't really know what that show would be, and I didn't really know what this show should be. I must be psychic for these pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We hope you'll be watching along. You may have already watched it. Let me know if you have any comments or feedback. Please don't spoil me. Episode 2 will drop tomorrow. So, yeah, Josh, what do you have going on, and where can people find
too
you?
Much. There's just
yes!
Too much. It's impossible to tell you everything that's going on, and that's a really beautiful thing about where Posture Recaps is right now. The thing that I keep saying is, if you're watching the show, there's a good chance that either we're covering it or we are aspiring to. And so we're in this place right now where we are just trying to get our arms around as much television as we possibly can. I'm in the middle of that with Better Call Saul, which is wrapping up the first half of its final season right now. Antonio and I are podcasting about that. Mike Bloom and I are ramping up for the return of Stranger Things. Season 4 is hitting, the first half of season 4 is hitting Netflix this coming Friday. Mike and I are going to be doing weekly podcasts about the show. They will. The first episode recap that we're going to do is going to be just us having seen that first episode of season four. Afterwards, we will have binged the whole thing, and there will be full spoilers to all of the recaps at that point moving forward. We're really excited about that. The reviews that we've seen, or at least like the impressions from people that have been allowed to be released, all seem pretty positive. So we're really excited about Stranger Things. So much more. Just, believe it or not, Walking Dead is still happening. The Fear of the Walking Dead is happening.
How?
I don't know.
How is it still happening?
Send Candy with the axe to the tower of Fear the Walking Dead. Solve a problem or two for us. And so many other shows that it's too hard to list them all off. But you can catch everything if you're subscribed to the main Post-Show Recaps podcast feed. And specifically for shows like Candy that are either all streaming at once or are these highly bingeable shows, we are housing these podcasts in the Binge Show Recaps podcast feed, which you can subscribe to by just searching Binge Show Recaps, Post Show Recaps in your podcatcher of choice. Or if you want to get the RSS link, postshowrecaps.com/binge will do the trick. Yeah. And then if you want to talk to me about Candy, because I will have seen the whole thing at this point, you can talk to me at Round Howard. That's where I am on the Twitter bot, Sarah. And then next thing for me will be eagerly anticipating episode two of the podcast drop with whoever it is that shall be joining you next to solve this crime.
Ooh, it's a rotating fairy floss of wonderful guests who are jumping on board the Candy train.
Candy Express.
Candy Express. You can follow me at Sarah Carradine. That's where I put everything that I'm doing, most notably over on RHAP. I have a crime scene review, a true crime review podcast that's called Crime Scene. Yes, we are looking at crime scenes with the amazing Mari Forth. So you can find me there. So it's time to say bye, y'all. And remember, good little Jedis, use the Force.